Right, here we are, Didactic Mind, Episode 6. The Gift of Gratitude is the title of this podcast, and the theme is gratitude. Very warm welcome to all of my listeners, wherever you might be. Very warm welcome to my regular readers from the blog, didactsreach.blogspot.com. Warm welcome to any casual listeners who have stopped by. Very warm welcome to my subscribers on SoundCloud. If you have not already subscribed to the SoundCloud uploads, please click the link and make sure you never miss a new episode. if you have not stopped by, if you have not stopped by the blog and had a look, then please make sure you do that as well. Any links to any articles that I discuss in this podcast over the next hour or so will of course be provided in the description box. I am back, and it has been a couple of weeks since I last did a podcast. It's mostly because I was traveling, and I was out basically on the beach, quite literally, for quite some time for the previous 2 weeks. So as a result, I did miss Thanksgiving, and I tried to post a Thanksgiving message just to make a basic point about gratitude. And I'll go over what I wrote in that post here, because I do think it's fairly important to understand the need for gratitude, particularly in a very ungrateful age. We live in a time when gratitude is really quite rare and quite precious. And it's more than just being grateful for the things you have. It's also being grateful for the lessons you've been taught. And that's a very, very hard thing to be. It's very hard to be grateful when you've been beaten down and punched in the face and kicked and shat on and spat upon and treated like shit for days, weeks, months, maybe even years on end. It's really hard to be grateful for the things you've been given, especially for the tests that you have to go through. But it's written in the scriptures to be grateful for your tests for a very good reason. The tests are what make you grow as a man, as a person, especially as a man. I mean, men need to be tested. We need to be pushed. We need to be forced to change and adapt. If we don't do that, we stagnate. We become brittle, and we become really very easy to move to anger. Whereas when you're tested constantly, you become stoic and calm. You become much more centered within yourself. You become more able to respond in times of great stress. And these are hard lessons to learn. It's really painful to have to go through these tests. But I've written about it time and time and time again. You know, I wrote a long post in response to a reader who wrote into me about the need to be grateful, which I'm going to reference here in the description box as well. Basically, this reader that I was talking with, his name is Veritas, or that's his handle on my blog, wrote in and told me about what he was going through. And he was writing in response to a couple of posts that I had written about fighting despair and nihilism. And this guy basically wrote in and he said to me, "Hi, Didact. I just wanted to thank you for providing some clarity and perspective. I really enjoyed your Antidotes to Despair article. I find myself in a somewhat similar situation. Suffice to say that the red pill was introduced to me rectally recently during some personal troubles. Reading through your articles and description of yourself, I find that we have a few things in common. Chief among these is probably the conservative mentality, which I can assure you is rarely found in our common ethnic group here in my country. I don't know if this is true for those from the motherland. Another is common effing sense. I enjoy unarmed combat and shoot with a rifle and pistol competitively. This, in spite of the fact that I am disabled and use a wheelchair. Fortunately, I still have almost normal use of my hands and mobility in my legs. I thank God every day for the little things. Only I know how much worse it could have been. I live in Africa, and my country is basically coitist, if you will. I'm trying to bail out, but the only option I have is in Southeast Asia, which isn't exactly the first world, but much safer than it is here at the moment. There's not much I have in common with the rest of our ethnic group. Much like yourself, I'm not a fan of their food, their movies, or their way of life. My career is in the doldrums given my age, and there are slim pickings as far as jobs are concerned. But life goes on. I refuse to be negative and just give up. That's why I found your article so inspirational at this point in my life. Anyway, I visit your blog daily, and I thoroughly enjoy it, predictably for the Friday TNA and the fine articles. If you're interested in writing about that shithole that is my country right now, I am your man on the ground. Thank you for listening to my condensed story. Take care, my friend. Now, Veritas wrote this back in June of this year, July, actually, of this year. And he wrote that at a time when I was in Moscow. And he wrote it at a time when I was also at a pretty low point myself. The articles that I had written reflected some of my own kind of personal struggles, but he wrote it at a time when I really needed to hear someone else being grateful to me for what I had given him. And I am grateful for that. There is a lot of gratitude from me to my readers as well, because they keep me honest, and they force me to face up to things that I get wrong, and I get a lot of things wrong a lot of the time. They make me realize that I'm not alone in this world, and that there are other people out there who get great inspiration from what I write, which is incredibly powerful feeling for me. And so it really just makes it worthwhile. I mean, I don't write or I don't talk for anybody other than myself. You know, me sitting here and talking to a microphone has absolutely nothing to do with making anybody else happy. This is, you know, an hour that I could have spent sleeping, really, in all honesty. But it's still an important part of who I am to share whatever little wisdom I have with the world. You know, I do believe in doing that. And I am very thankful for the opportunity to be able to do that. You know, I don't get paid for this, but I don't really care. I would do this anyway. And the goal of this podcast, the goal of reading out these articles, is to show you that as bad as you think your life is, there's always somebody out there who's worse off. There's always somebody out there who's in a lot more pain and misery than you. And there's always somebody out there who needs your help. And you probably need his too, in a strange way. Many of you listening will be familiar with my story, you know, where I basically lost everything. I mean, I lost my job, I lost my locational security. I lost everything that was important to me at the time. And I had to come back to the old country. I had to move back in with my parents. I've been here for a year and a half, basically, on and off. You know, I've been trying to get away as much as I can and be independent again, be on my own. But this is my home base now for the foreseeable future. And it's not fun. I don't enjoy it. I don't enjoy being away from my stuff, my things. I don't enjoy being dependent upon other people. I don't enjoy being in a city that is not of my own choosing, living a lifestyle that is not of my own choosing. But there's still a lot to be grateful for. It could always be worse. Veritas is disabled, basically. And look at how cheerful he is, how easily he gets up in the morning and just carries on living, carries on doing what matters to him, keeps trying to be better at what he does. That's inspirational. That's amazing. That's profoundly good and worthy of praise. And that's what separates those who are grateful for, with their lives, from those who are not grateful. The idiots that you see raging on the streets of the United States, the biggest cities in the US, the morons that you see rioting in London right now, you know, right this minute, over the results of the general election in the UK on Friday the 13th, which turned out to be a very lucky day after all. You know, praise be to Boris Johnson, and thank God for him and for the nationalists and the hardworking blue-collar men and women who gave him the mandate. The people that you see screaming their heads off incoherently in the streets and smashing windows and setting shops on fire and basically acting like violent, spoiled brats are really ungrateful people. That's what ingratitude does. It makes you mean and pathetic and weak and whiny. It makes you incapable of seeing, of accepting defeat, of taking stock, of realizing that the problem isn't with everybody else, the problem is with you, of understanding that you now need to bend and change. I've been tested in this manner more times than I can count over the past year and a half. Whether it's in a relationship with a woman, or in my own personal circumstances, or in my relationships with other people, I've had to realize time and time and time and time and time and time and time again that the problem is me. It's not with these other people where I'm failing to communicate with them. It's not because they are bad people. It's because I am not a good person myself. It's because there's something wrong with me that stops me from being effective at talking to and reaching out to and being empathetic with these people. There's something within me that has to change. And as people who have known me keep telling me, yeah, I have changed. I have become much more flexible, much easier, much more willing to listen to people, much less, I wouldn't say dogmatic necessarily in my opinions, because I am pretty strident in what I say and what I think, but at least more willing to listen to another point of view that may not agree at all with my own. And I always thought I was pretty tolerant about such things to begin with, but it turns out I'm not, especially when I'm dealing with fields where I have really no expertise whatsoever, where I think, initially at least, that field has nothing whatsoever to contribute to my life. I'm talking specifically about the field of psychology, where, you know, I have said many horrible things about psychology in the past, and, by the way, I stand by most of them. But I can no longer deny that certain aspects of psychotherapy can help you. That's why, in previous podcasts, I have said to people who have been listening, look, if you need to talk to somebody, if you don't have a friend nearby, if nothing else works, just get a therapist. Do some therapy to confront some of the problems that exist in your life and get them out of the way. I couldn't forgive the people who damaged my life without therapy. And I'm not making that up. That's actually 100% true. I would prefer that it was Christian therapy, of course, because I think that any other kind of therapy which points you away from God and towards secular solutions is going to fail over time. Because the problem with therapy is that, you know, it's broken people trying to fix other broken people using broken human methods. And inevitably that's not going to work. You know, at some point you're going to run into some serious problems. But the result of doing those things was that I actually became grateful for the tests that I had to endure. Because I'll tell you what my biggest fear has always been, always, you know, throughout my whole life, that I would end up without a job and homeless on the street. That's the thing that really scares me the most, is failing on such a profound level, so completely, so totally, that I end up kicked out on the streets, living rough. That would be such a fall from grace, such a terrible way to live, such a, you know, total destruction of everything that I was taught, such a profound humiliation, that I don't know I'd ever be able to recover from that. And I came closer than I've ever been to that 18 months ago. I've come closer to that, you know, in the months since. It's never gotten that bad, because I know I will always have a roof over my head at some point, you know, somewhere. I'll always be accepted into somebody's house. I'll always be able to live somewhere. But it was a sobering realization, and I realized just how much of a kicking I could take. I came close to breaking, but I didn't break. Not completely. It's still rough and still difficult to deal with what happened, but it is what it is, right? You have to kind of accept it and move on. I mean, every single thing that I've tried to get out of my current situation has failed. Every single thing. And yet, I'm not whining about it. I'm not complaining about it. I simply have to accept it. And I'm grateful for it in my own strange way. Because that gratitude for these tests makes me realize that those who are testing me, or those who are doing this to me, aren't doing it out of malice. They're not doing it out of spite. They're just doing it because it's in their own best interests. And if our positions were reversed, yeah, I'd probably do it to them, hopefully more compassionately. But if I was just looking out for my naked self-interest, that's probably what I would do too. And don't let anybody who's listening to this fool yourself into thinking that you wouldn't do the same. Would. You absolutely would. You would fire people who aren't performing. You would cut ties with an individual who's not working out as an employee. Just, you know, not because he's not working hard, not because he's not doing his job, but because circumstances beyond your control make it impossible for him to come over and work where you work. At a certain point, you have to say, okay, well, you know, we really gave it a good old college try. That didn't work. And you have to be grateful for the people in your life. You have to be grateful for the good things that are in it. You know, it's hard to imagine being grateful when, to take an extreme example, let's say, you've been to Iraq and you've had, you were in a Humvee where you were out on patrol, and you ran over an IED and the IED detonated and your best buddies were killed in the car beside you, and you yourself wind up blind and a multiple amputee in a Veterans Association hospital in the U.S., you know, with everything, all of the pain and the misery that results. There are cases of men who've ended up like that. There's one case I remember reading on Breitbart of a veteran who was in exactly that situation. I don't think he ended up blind, but he basically lost 3 out of his 4 limbs or something like that. And he ended up raising a whole bunch of money. If I've got this correctly, I think he ended up raising a whole huge heap of money for the border wall. I could be wrong about this. I'll have to go look it up, but that was my initial impression and results of this story. That guy found what to be grateful for, and he became a paragon of his community. He made a difference in the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. If you take Mark Luttrell, the lone survivor, you know, he lost 3 out of the 4 members of his team. He was the only survivor of Operation Red Wings from the ground team. And a number of other SEALs were killed in a helicopter trying to rescue him. I believe it was 19 other SEALs died trying to rescue him from the side of that mountain in Afghanistan. He broke his back and fractured his vertebrae. He had multiple broken bones. He had severe gunshot wounds, multiple lacerations, you know, just extremely badly injured. He was eventually airlifted out to safety, and then he ended up fracturing his spine and blowing out both his knees shortly afterwards, you know, about a year afterwards, you know, a year after convalescing and recovering. He had a therapy dog, which I think was named Daisy, something like that, D-A-S-Y, where the letters, the initials of the 4 letters stood for each of the members of his team that was killed up on the mountainside. And that dog was shot by just some random assholes who came over and, you know, thought it would be fun to shoot a defenseless dog. And he ended up chasing them through something like 4 counties before they were finally arrested. And 2 of the men, I think it was 2 men, one of them was convicted for cruelty to animals, and the other was convicted of a slightly lesser charge. And I think they only ended up serving, you know, a maximum sentence of like 3 years, if that. I'll have to go look up the details of the story, but this is the gist of it. You know, this guy was just beaten down, brutalized in every way possible. Every year, when it comes time to around that time of that period where Operation Red Wings happened, his wife says that he just retreats into himself completely. For 1 week, he becomes unapproachable. He just shuts himself away from everyone, and he goes into a period of mourning for the men that died with him. That man has started an NGO, a non-profit charity to help other veterans reintegrate into society. He has 2 wonderful children with a loving wife who he's crazy about and who really supports him. He's found purpose and meaning in his life outside of the military. His story has been told on the big screen by none other than Mark Wahlberg, who, you know, there is another story of redemption and decency, of humanity, of gratitude. Mark Wahlberg, you know, was a teen heartthrob. He was a white rapper. He was a gangster rapper, basically, before gangster rap really became a thing. Been a long day. He became an action megastar, and then he started segueing into more serious films. And as badly as he behaved in his youth, I mean, if you watch a Top Gear interview of him, he talks about, like, literally stealing people's cars and driving off, you know, waving the finger at the police. He was such an unruly guy in his late teens and early 20s and even mid-20s that he got into a physical altercation with a man, a Vietnamese guy, in his neighborhood in Boston, and beat the guy so badly that the man lost sight in one of his eyes. And, you know, 20 years later, he went back to this same man and begged his forgiveness for what he'd done, because Mark Wahlberg is a strong Christian. He believes in the Christian faith. And he acknowledges, Lord, you know, Christ as Lord, Christ as King. And he went back and he asked this man for forgiveness, and he got it. And he managed to reconcile with someone that he'd done something terrible to. And he was able to find purpose and pride in his life. He was able to become a much better person because he embraced this idea of gratitude for all things that he has. Over and over and over and over and over again, the people that you find to be the most admirable, the most decent, the most profoundly good, are the ones who have embraced gratitude. Gratitude is the way out. It's the way to get past all the shit in your life. If you have a shitty life, you can always find something to be grateful for. I'll give you another example. I've written about this in my Thanksgiving post about Diogenes the Cynic. Alexander the Great, at the height of his conquest of Greece, went to... where was it exactly? He went to... I wrote about this story. He went to meet the old philosopher, I think in Sinope itself. I could be wrong about that. You know, this is Plutarch's retelling, so go read his version of events if you want to know what happened. But basically, the way Plutarch tells it, Alexander the Great went to meet Diogenes because Diogenes the Cynic was this legendary philosopher in Greece. And Alexander, being educated by Aristotle, had great respect for Greek philosophers and wanted to learn from them. And having heard of the wisdom of Diogenes, he went to him, and Diogenes was sitting out on the, somewhere in the city, basically sunbathing. He was just chilling, chillaxing, lying out, spread out on probably a stone bench or a stone floor of some kind, and was just enjoying the day, just relaxing, just letting the sun's rays soak into him. And Alexander the Great, the man who would conquer the entire known world at the time, walked over to him and said to him, "Great philosopher, wise man, I am Alexander. I have conquered all Greece, and I will conquer the world. I will give you anything in my power that you ask for, anything at all. All you have to do is ask what you wish, and it will be granted to you because of your wisdom and your ability to pass that wisdom on to others." Diogenes looked the younger man up and down, and he said, "Anything at all?" And Alexander the Great nodded, smiled, said, "Anything you wish." Diogenes just said, "Well, then stand out of my light." That tells you everything you need to know about what it means to be grateful. This is a guy who had basically nothing. I mean, the old cynics were strong believers in, like, essentially being, taking vows of poverty, if you will, almost, and living a very monk-like, hermit-like existence. They subsisted on the goodness of others, the mercy and charity of others.
Sorry.
For the most part. They took offerings when given, but overall, they were not rich men. They just existed on whatever they could get. And Diogenes was grateful for all that he had, to the extent that when offered everything he could possibly dream of, he just said, "I just want a little bit more light. Stand out. Move out of my way." That's it. That's the essence of a grateful man. A man who finds richness and purpose in the little things in life. The little things such as holding your woman close to you, embracing her tightly as you're going to sleep, listening to the gurgling laughter of your children when they wake up, enjoying a beautiful sunny day, sitting on a beach and watching the sunset, watching the beauty of the countryside go by as you're driving down a road, enjoying a good book and seeing the words leap off the page and into your mind, listening to beautiful classical music, listening to Beethoven's, to the fifth movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, or the majesty of Handel's Messiah, or just about anything by Bach, or the 1812 Overture by Tchaikovsky, or buying a cheap ticket to see some unknown flamenco guitarist who comes in, sits down, proceeds to play a set, and you don't even know what he's doing, but it sounds beautiful. Or sitting, you know, in a hut by a beach, listening to some Indonesian natives singing their own folk melodies, or looking at the Kremlin in Russia, you know, and going to Moscow and just standing next to the Kremlin and admiring the architecture, or sitting in church and communing with the Lord. Just these little things, these are the things to be grateful for. The attentions of a dog on the street. You know, you gave a stray dog and his family some cream. You poured it into a bowl a few times, you passed by. You know, it cost you a dollar, maybe two, and you bought a big container of heavy cream and you stirred it up and you poured it into a bowl and you gave it to the dog and his family to drink, and he remembers that, the dog remembers that, and he comes scampering after you and he runs after you and tries to jump all over you and tries to lick you, and, you know, because it's a stray, you can't really pet it too much, but these attentions, these are what matter in life. These are the things that make men happy. These are the things that really put things into perspective. This is what matters. These are the good things. Be grateful for them. Be grateful and understanding that they can be removed from you. And they can be removed from you very, very easily. Part of the reason why I'm so tired, it's not just because it's like 11:30 at night where I am, and, you know, I'm usually in bed by 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. Part of the reason I'm so tired is because I was at the funeral of my uncle, my father's sister's husband, today. He died about 10 days ago of lung cancer. Now, the cancer diagnosis happened back in 2015. Or thereabouts. It must have been, yeah, around about then. Now, in 2015, I lost my granddad, and my father lost his family home because of just stuff I won't even get into because it's just too painful and too much family politics. He has his house here, obviously, and it's a much nicer and bigger house and so on, so he's not bothered about that, but it's just the loss of the place where he had so many happy memories, where, you know, he brought his family to spend time with his parents. I grew up every year going back to the old country to spend time with my grandparents. It was a big deal. It was our favorite time of year. It's my favorite holiday. Christmas time was my favorite time of year, and still is. Nowadays, it's my favorite time of year for a very different reason. But back then, it was my favorite time of year because, oh, I was going back to meet my grandparents. And we were going to spend the holidays with them, and that was so much fun. It was wonderful. And it really was. But that was all gone. And more bad news just kept coming. You know, the brother of my dad's best friend from business school died suddenly on the operating table because of cancer. That had spread much farther than anybody expected. My uncle was diagnosed with lung cancer, and he went in for chemotherapy and operations. Other members of my father's generation began to die out and die off and be struck down with terrible illnesses. And today, you know, I was reminded of just how easy it is to have everything you care about, everything you love, taken away from you. You know, my aunt was there, and a whole bunch of people from her family, her friends, people that my family has known for many years, showed up. And she was holding it together for a while, but she eventually just broke down in tears. And when the funeral ceremony started, when the wake started, as it were, with the ceremonies going on and the officiating and the chants and so on, whatever it's called, I really don't care. But I don't care about pagan rites. I have no interest in such things. But the nature of the ceremony was to help everybody just come to terms with what had happened. That this husband, father, good and decent man in his own way, was gone forever. He wasn't coming back. And, you know, my aunt was brave and she was strong and she'd kind of had time mentally to prepare, because for the previous 6 months he had been gradually declining, and then finally when the final decline happened, it was very fast. I mean, it happened in the space of a month, you know. Everything just went very quickly, to the point where he passed away after, you know, about 2 weeks of serious illness. And she just broke down. She really started crying, and I just held her close and didn't say anything. Just gave her a big hug, and as she sobbed into my shoulder, and that was, you know, that was 12 hours ago, maybe 13 hours ago that happened. As I'm recording this, anyway, it was difficult to see and difficult to watch. I wasn't even very close to my uncle. He was a good guy, but for whatever reason, various family politics, people drifted apart over the years. And I didn't feel guilty about not being close to him, but I did feel great sadness at the fact that he was gone, and all those memories, happy memories that I have from childhood, went with him. But the thing is, that pain and that loss is the price that we have to pay for the good times. And I know that's very hard to understand. It's very hard to hear. It's impossible for somebody who's grieving to hear those words. But it's true. Vox Day, you know, some weeks ago, lost his wife's dog, died. And this is what he said, basically, that the pain he's feeling now is the price that he has to pay for the good times that he had. And he wouldn't trade those good times for anything. He wouldn't, you know, like, trying to avoid that pain is pointless. It's going to happen. You're going to be exposed to pain and heartbreak no matter what. So you might as well do it. You might as well be grateful for the joy that you get, knowing full well that there's going to be a price to pay for that. The thing to remember is that gratitude for the joy and the pleasure and the comfort and the enjoyment of things, and especially of people, is what makes it worthwhile, what makes the pain endurable. If you can find the joy in these things, if you can be grateful for the joy that you have, then the pain itself, as miserable as it is, as horrible as it is, just gets put into perspective. You don't have to deal with it so much anymore. It's not so bad anymore, because you have something to offset it, something that's much bigger and better. And again, I know these words don't make sense to anybody who's grieving, anybody who's in pain, anybody who's going through difficulty in life. But you're going to find that as you are tested and you grow and you change and you become better, the pains that you go through are going to fade into memory. And you're going to look back on a lot of these things and you're going to think to yourself, yeah, that wasn't so bad. Yeah, it was. I wouldn't wish it on anybody else. I would never want anyone else to go through what I went through. But I'm glad I went through it. The people who say that, the people who say, I'm glad I went through it, are the ones who grow up the fastest. They're the ones who become, who achieve their maximum potential every time. If you actually look at the people who achieve truly amazing things and are truly admirable and good people, the kind that people like me will probably never be, because I'm not a good person. I admit that. I'm not a good person at all. And nobody should be looking to me as an example of somebody to follow. But the people that I admire the most are always the ones who say, I went through pain, I went through misery, and I'm glad I went through it, because it made me stronger, it made me tougher, it made me wiser, it made me gentler and kinder and more decent. It made me appreciate what I've got. What I've got is so much more important than what I lost. These are the people you want to follow. These are the people you want to admire. These are the people who really know what it means to be empathetic, to be good, and to do good things for other people, not because it makes them look good, not because it makes them feel good, but because it is good for other people to receive that gift of gratitude. And again, it is a gift. So for those of you, as we go into Christmas time, which is my favorite time of the year, and you know, by far, I mean, Christmas Day is my absolute favorite day of the year. My single favorite day. I just turn into a little kid whenever Christmas comes around. You know, be grateful for the things that you get and the things that you have. And even when things go wrong, be grateful for that eventually. Because last year, last Christmas, I was in Moscow. I spent Christmas away from my family. And it was the worst Christmas I've ever had. And it wasn't just because of my family. You know, there's a lot of personal stuff going on, which I won't get into. It was just awful. I remember at the end of the night, sitting at a dinner table with my head in my hands, thinking, what have I done? What am I doing here? I seriously left my family behind for this horrible day where I thought I was celebrating the birth of the Savior, and here I am caught up in all this personal drama. But you know what? The next day still rolled around. Things still happened. We still moved on. Things just went on. Life carried on. One day, as important as it was to me, wasn't the defining event of my life. And with time and with perspective, I realized that a lot of the reason why that Christmas was so miserable was because of me. It's because of stuff I did. And I needed to make some changes, and I did. Will this year's Christmas be any better? Probably not, actually. Or at least it'll be bad in a different way, because, you know, I'm in a different place, but I'm not necessarily happy where I am. And I'm in a different situation, but I'm right back to square zero in a lot of ways. So, you know, I could sit there and dwell on how bad things are and get caught up in my own misery. Or I could just be grateful for the way things have unfolded. The fact that I have been tested and pushed and broken down and beaten down so hard and so frequently. Because I do believe very firmly that these beatings, and that is what they are life just beating me down, are preparations for something much bigger and much more important, where I'm going to have to do things that I don't even know if I can do. I don't even know if I'm capable of doing them. But I have to do them. Because it's not just about me at that point. It's about doing something far bigger than myself for people beyond myself. And if I can do that, if I have learned the lessons of humility grace and wisdom necessary to do these things, then it was worth it. It was worth the pain. It was worth the sacrifice. It was worth the misery. So that's the right way, at least I think. You know, I see, as we all do, I see through a glass darkly. That's what I think is necessary to live a decent and virtuous life. Or at least that's the start of it. Be grateful for what you have. And it's not accidental or coincidental that this season of gratitude begins, at least in America, with Thanksgiving. I want to close off talking about Thanksgiving itself. Where did it come from? Why did it become such an important holiday? You have to remember that the story that we're all told about Thanksgiving as children is very fanciful and really not particularly accurate. The pilgrims who came over to the original colonies, to Plymouth Rock, landed and tried to create for themselves, basically a communist society. They created a colony where effectively land ownership was communal, so there was no individual private property. Now, anybody who knows anything about history knows immediately that when you have communal land ownership, nothing ever gets done. The hardworking guys slack off because they know that they'll never get rewarded for what they do, and the lazy guys sit back and think, well, great, I can be lazy because the hardworking idiots will cover my end of the share. Nothing happens. People starve in the end, and that's exactly what happened. The population of I think it was Jamestown, basically dropped by half from its inception. The population of the Plymouth Rock colony suffered similarly. I mean, it just was destroyed by astonishingly inept and stupid management, mismanagement. And the reason was because the pilgrims who came over on that first wave of ships took entirely the wrong message from scriptures. They took completely the wrong message from the ideals portrayed by Jesus Christ about the best ways to share and share alike. They did not realize that private property was central to Christ's message in many ways. The sovereignty of the individual, the right of the individual to choose his own life, his own path in life. In obedience to God, yes, absolutely, but of his own free will. They missed that message completely. The reason why the colonists survived was because of Squanto. Tisquantum was his actual name. Now, if you look at Squanto's actual life, this was a guy who had more reason than almost anybody to be unhappy and ungrateful. He was captured by Englishmen and pressed into slavery. And he was a slave. He was enslaved and sent to England to work under terrible conditions. But he somehow found it within himself. He found the strength and the grace and the wisdom to accept Christ into his life. He became a Christian. And he learned English. He learned how to speak the language of his captors. And when he was set free and he returned back to America, he found the colonists and he found fellow Christians in the process. And he taught them the local, Wampanoag and in Native American methods for cultivating corn and other crops from the soil, including burying fish heads under the soil to fertilize said soil. And to celebrate that the bountiful harvest after that first year where Squanto showed up, a group of Indians, a group of Native Americans, I should say, showed up from the forest, I think it was five of them, with deer and meat and fish, and the pilgrims put together a spread with the crops that they had created, and they gave thanks to the Lord for the fact that they had been delivered into the new world and been given a second chance. They were grateful for the trials that they had suffered and the deliverance that they had received, providential deliverance. And that is where we get the tradition of thanksgiving from. We give thanks to a sovereign, a deity, who has given us more than we can possibly appreciate. And we try to accept within ourselves the humility and the grace to be grateful for even the hard times, even the things, the instructions that we receive from doing things wrong. That's a hard lesson to learn. It's very, very profoundly difficult to learn this. But that's what gratitude is all about, is accepting when you've done something stupid, something really wrong, accepting that you've made mistakes, accepting that you need to change, and being grateful for the forces that made you a better person. You know, come Thanksgiving time, I am very grateful for my family, even though I don't always see eye to eye with them. I'm very grateful for everybody who reads my work, people who read my blog, people who listen to my podcast. Now, anyway, I'm very grateful for the friends and loved ones in my life who have made me a better person. You know, not always cheaply for them. I mean, I can name at least one person who suffered terribly in trying to make me less of an ass, and that person really, really paid a very high price for what that person did in order to improve me, for the patience and the tolerance and the forgiveness that I received from that person. You know, it's profoundly hard to deal with somebody as stubborn as me. I mean, I'm not, I have a lot of faults. I'm extremely stubborn. I am extremely harsh when dealing with ideas that I think are downright stupid. I mean, I say so openly. I'm like, that's an idiotic idea, and I treat it with utter contempt. I am very brutal in terms of my ability to just take an idea and analyze the crap out of it. But I'm also very inexperienced in a lot of ways in many areas of life. So, you know, when I attack somebody's ideas, that person often thinks that I'm attacking him or her. And I'm not. I'm just attacking a bad idea as I see it as a bad idea. But not everybody thinks that way, you know. And it takes time and effort to develop the necessary empathy to accept someone else's point of view. And above all, I'm profoundly grateful to God the Father of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, who entered my life in ways that I didn't really understand or believe in, and who changed it in a lot of ways, in very profound ways. I mean, Jesus is Lord, Jesus is King. I say that without reservation, without irony. 15 years ago, these words would have been ridiculous. I would have laughed at anybody who said them. But I had to be broken really badly through deaths in my family to come around to the point of view that, hey, maybe this Christianity stuff has something to it. And you can see that, you know, in my writings. It's right there on my blog. You can see how my views of religion have changed over time. The final piece of advice that I'll give to anybody listening who is going through tough times and is trying to understand how to be grateful and is trying to understand the effect that gratitude has, is to remember how a Japanese katana blade is formed. The katana is a particularly special kind of sword. It's actually made of two pieces of metal. The central piece of metal, the core of the sword, is made out of low-carbon, high, like, very tough, but not, like, it's basically made out of a low-carbon core. And the problem with low-carbon steel is that it doesn't retain an edge very well. So you can only really create a straight bar or, you know, a straight line out of it. The outer sword, the actual blade of the sword, the sharp bit, the bit that, you know, you use to stab and slash people with, is made out of very high carbon tempered steel, which has a lot of the impurities burned out of it. But the problem with high carbon steel is that it is brittle. It breaks easily. Now, to form this sword, the iron has to be forged, combined, you know, into alloy and made into steel, and it has to be folded over and over again. It has to be repeatedly stuck back in the furnace and hammered out, and cooled off, and then stuck back in, hammered out, folded over and over and over again. Now, it's a myth that Japanese swords, katana blades, are folded, you know, 1,000 times. That's nonsense. That's not true at all. In reality, katana blades are folded, the steel is folded. You can only really fold it a maximum of about 15 times before the steel essentially loses all of its differentiating properties and becomes just one molten mass of junk. You know, you can't use it anymore. But the analogy still holds nonetheless, that you have to be stuck back in the furnace and pulled out and hammered and forged into something better. And then once you go through that process, you're stuck back in the furnace again, hammered out, turned into something better. But you still have defects, so you're put back in again, hammered out, you know, turned into something better. And the result is this masterpiece of metallurgy and craftsmanship. Now, katana blades can still be broken. It's not that hard to break a katana blade. If you smash a sword, a katana, into anything hard enough, especially with an edge, it will snap. It will shatter. It will break in two. It's not hard to find footage of this happening on YouTube. But the point remains nonetheless that these swords are considered masterworks and masterpieces because they have the soul of a master craftsman embedded within them. That's what you have within you. You have a spark of the divine within you. And that divine sword maker, that divine craftsman, is trying to make you into something that you don't even fully understand yet. Let him. Let go. Be grateful to him for what you're going to endure. When the time comes, you'll be ready for the purpose that he has in mind for you. That's all for this episode of Didactic Mind, episode 6, as I said. I'm back, and I plan to try to catch up on the 2 episodes that I missed. So hopefully I will record those over the coming days and weeks as I have time and capacity and uninterrupted solitude to do so. So stick around. If you haven't subscribed, as I said, subscribe now. And I will see you all on the next one. Take care.